Accession number 12920, Richard Harland, reel 1.
Richard Harland, reel 1. So, Richard, could I then ask you something about your background, you know, where you were born and brought up, and the sort of family life you had as a youngster?
Yes. Well, I was born in Scarborough. My parents were Methodists. My mother had come from a Congregationalist family in Scarborough. They were very sympathetic to the Quakers in Scarborough. Scarborough has always had a very strong connection with the Society of Friends. Roundtree's and other famous names are linked with it. And one of the incidents which was recounted to me and must have made a lot of impression on me, I think, was how during the Boer War, the Roundtrees, the Friends in Scarborough, in fact, called a meeting about South Africa, and they were, on the whole, pro-Boer. And there was a riot in Scarborough at that time. The windows were broken, the Roundtrees suffered a lot of damage, and the Roundtree shops suffered a lot of damage. And my parents, and especially my mother, spoke admiringly of the Quaker stance there. That must have made an impression, I think. My father had been in the First War. My uncle Richard, after whom I was named, was killed in the last few days of the First War, and that was very traumatic to me, very sad to me. And so I remember very deeply the armistice days when I was at school from the age of 8 onwards. I went to the local secondary school at that age. At that time it seemed a huge school of 450 boys, and the armistice day with its the gun booming out at 2:58, and what was it, at 11 o'clock? At 11 o'clock, and then 2 minutes absolute silence. At that time, in those days, everything stopped. The cars stopped in the street. And it was really a very impressive thing. I was very conscious at that time of my uncle having died in the war.
As you grew up, you know, did you find you were thinking more about issues of war and peace? You know, I'm wondering about the development of your pacifist ideas.
I can't honestly remember that they were developing. I was not a political animal, really, at all. Nor were my parents. I think they voted Liberal, but they were not active in any sense at all. Then, at the age of 13, almost 14, I was sent to a Quaker school, Bootham, at York. And that was, of course, a big experience. And I was there for 5 years and absorbed a tremendous amount and received an enormous amount of care and guidance there. And I remember well, for example, some of the Sunday evening meetings when there was an outside speaker, and some of those who came, such as Corder Catchpool, and I remember him. He must have been a charismatic personality. He was so quiet and gentle, but it came through the humility and the modesty of the man. It was a great thing. And then, when I was, I suppose, 16 or 17, I got caught up in the work camp movement under Jack Hoyland, and went two or three times on a work camp with him. At that time, of course, there was terrible distress among the miners, coal miners, and Jack ran work camps in South Yorkshire and in South Wales, and I went on some of these. We used to stay in the miners' houses, and we used to pay our board and lodging, which no doubt helped them, and we were working mainly on helping them, supposedly helping them to dig their allotments or other such work as that, or creating new allotments for them. Jack was a passionate pacifist, and I absorbed a lot of his feelings at that time. There was also another remarkable person of an older generation who was closely associated with the school, Neave Brayshaw. He had been a teacher, but upon his retirement he was, I think, funded by some Roundtree Trust to travel among the schools and to give courses of talks to the boys, and he was a big influence. He in fact did live in Scarborough, so I saw quite a lot of him. Very rotund and a person with a very recognizable and rather comical voice, but a tremendous influence.
So your pacifism was developing, would you say, with contact mm-hmm. with these people?
It must have been, yes. Yes, another event during those years was the Spanish Civil War. People talked about that. As I say, I was still pretty non-political. I didn't understand the issues at all, but it was there were spin-offs from it. For example, if one was tempted to leave any food on your plate, they would say, there are children starving in Spain. And that's a small thing, but bigger things, yes, also rubbed off, I'm sure, from that conflict.
Would you have been aware at this stage, you know, in the mid-1930s, Richard, of Hitler and what was happening in Europe? You know, did that impinge on your young life?
Well, yes, I can't remember any direct contacts, but through speakers, the Sunday evening meeting speakers in particular, and at other times. Corder Catpool, of course, had been involved in Germany. He'd been the Quaker representative in Berlin and had helped them, given enormous help to Jews escaping from Germany and in other ways. He'd been in close contact with the Nazi leaders, had interviews even with Hitler himself and so on. Yes, I think so. But I can't remember specifically knowing much about Nazi Germany at that time.
Did you have any contact with refugees when they started coming to this country?
I don't think so, no. At some Quaker schools, there were refugees actually among the boys, but no, I don't remember any. The nearest, I'm not sure whether he was a very early refugee. He was Michael Polanyi. Polanyi was the father's name, and I can't remember now the son's name. He was at Bootham, and he was a very distinguished scientist. His speciality was heavy water and such like, physical things, physical science. Beyond that, I don't think I can remember much.
How about the peace movement? You know, I'm thinking of things like the Peace Pledge Union and the various other groups that existed. Did you have anything to do with them at that time?
No, I was aware of the Peace Pledge Union. I didn't send the postcard, but I was aware of it, and of Dick Shepherd. But I wasn't involved. I didn't do anything, I'm afraid.
Can you remember, Richard, the outbreak of World War II?
Yes, I remember the... Well, I remember. Oh, one other recollection. Yes, I remember Munich. and I think the school was assembled to hear the broadcast by Chamberlain. And the debate which went on, and a lot of people were appalled by that. I still myself wasn't sufficiently able to understand the politics of that, nor indeed to take any very strong sides for or against Munich. But I remember the occasion. I can just hear it almost today. The broadcast by Chamberlain.
Did you have a feeling then that war might be coming?
Oh yes. Oh yes, yes, it was a... Yes, indeed, it was a frightening year, that. I left Buhlen at Christmas, it must have been, 1938. I'd got a scholarship to Oxford, and the system at that time was that was in the autumn term, and then you had two terms free. And so I went to, during those two terms, yes, I went first of all to about a month to Woodbrook, the Quaker College in Birmingham, for a short course there, and then I went to Geneva and stayed in the Quaker hostel there, and I was extraordinarily diligent to going around all the League of Nations institutions and committees, and sat in on everything I could sit in on. I remember from starting at the top. I remember the assembly. I remember the assembly of the League of Nations with Lord Halifax speaking, a very distinguished figure. And the main subject of discussion I remember on that occasion was the Åland Islands. It says just off from Sweden, isn't it? It's spelled A-A-L-A-N-D, which... Russia was, the Soviet Union was claiming, I think. I forget again the politics of that, but that was certainly discussed. And then I went to I remember going to a drugs committee and one or two other human rights associated committees of the League of Nations, as well as some. Stopped there. I think that was about the extent of the committee they went to. But I went to a lot. I followed the League of Nations work at that time and studied it carefully. They had the little League of Nations handbook and all sorts of other documents.
Well, this is very interesting. What were the hopes at that time? Because this is quite soon before the outbreak of war, I imagine.
Yes.
What were the hopes of the League still in the late 1930s?
Well, the hopes were that it could still bring peace. There had been, I haven't mentioned this, but it comes back to me now, there had been the Abyssinia crisis, of course, and one felt that the League of Nations had been powerless there to take a strong line. But what strong line could they have taken short of war? It was one was so mixed up, one didn't know what should have been done for the best. But take for example that issue of the Åland Islands. One just hoped that some means could be found through the League of Nations of finding a settlement there. But I think no settlement was found.
As the war, was drawing near, and you have mentioned Munich earlier, Richard.
Yes.
Were you thinking about your own position, as a young man coming up to 19?
Yes. I must have been. Yes, I must have been. But And I'm sure I was feeling that it was quite impossible for me to fight. I know that was so.
Could I ask you, at this stage, you know, did you know anything about COs in World War One and what had happened to them?
No, I don't think I did. I don't think that had come into my consciousness, really, no. I'm reconstructing here, I must have heard from speakers at Bootham School, I must have heard, but I don't remember.
So, you were saying, you know, the actual outbreak of war on the 3rd of September 1939, can you remember where you were when you heard about that?
I think I was at home, yes, I think I was at home. But I can't remember the occasion, the actual broadcast. I can't remember the place of the broadcast, I remember the broadcast. Very clearly, but I can't remember where I was sitting at the time. And I remember my father was... I was with my parents, clearly. My father was distressed, very distressed. And I felt associated with that distress.
Did you realise that you would be involved?
Yes. I think he's... His emotion and consequently mine was, we just don't know where this is going to lead, but it's going to lead to terrible things of which we cannot forecast the outcome. Or indeed, we don't know what's going to happen. It's going to be an awful time ahead of us.
Had you any sort of idea of what you were going to do? You know, having made up your mind that you couldn't fight, did you know, for instance, that there were provisions for people who wanted to be COs?
Yes, I must have known. I must have known, but I can't remember actually knowing. And I must have known that about the Friends Ambulance Unit in the First World War. I must have known, but I can't remember knowing.
So can you remember deciding to be a CO and going to register?
No, it was clearly... I went to Oxford in September, and it must have been at least 18 months after that I had to register, but I don't remember the actual registration process, but I did register as a CO, and in due course applied for, and in due course came before a tribunal, and that I do remember slightly. It was a fairly peaceful event. No, I ought to go back a bit there, because my brother was a CO2. And it was during he must have registered before I did. He was older than me, 3 years older than me. So he must have registered very soon after the beginning of the war, and he had a tribunal in Newcastle before a notorious judge, who was the county court judge, who was the tribunal chairman in Newcastle. His name escapes me for the moment. And he was a cruel and vicious man, by all accounts. There were headlines in our local paper about my brother's tribunal, all that distance away in Scarborough. And that distressed my mother especially a lot, I know. He went initially farming. My uncle was a farmer, so he went to work on my uncle's farm. And in due course, he went to China to teach geology. He was a geologist. During any holidays or vacation, university vacations at that time, I used to go farming during those first year or so of the war, either with my uncle or somewhere else. We had various farming contacts in the Scarborough district.
Your tribunal, you know, if I could go back
yes,
to that,
yes. I'm sorry. Well, I muddled that, didn't I? Yes.
Oh, not at all.
Got the chronology wrong. Yes.
The tribunal. Whereabouts would this have been held? Because you were at Oxford at the time.
Yes, and it was held in Oxford. That's right. And it was a very, very difficult decision to know what sort of service to apply for, what sort of condition to apply for. And I know I felt that I mustn't... It would have been easy, I suppose, to apply for unconditional exemption or to apply for exemption conditional upon service in the FAU, but I didn't feel that it would have been integrity to apply for that, because I didn't feel it was impossible for me to serve in the RAMC, Royal Army Medical Corps, and so I was at that time prepared to serve in the RAMC, and that counted as non-combatant service. The Royal Engineers, the RE, or I think the RAOC, was it, was also regarded as non-combatant. And if I'd been drafted to those, I cannot think what I'd have done. I wouldn't have been happy in the least bit. But somehow, so far as I can recollect, I was pretty confident that if I applied for the RAMC, I would be enabled to enter the RAMC, and that was what I was prepared to do. And so, for some technical reason, legal reason, I suppose, the tribunal couldn't themselves say conditional upon RAMC service. They had to say conditional upon non-combatant service. And so that was what, in fact, they did award.
And you accepted that?
I accepted that, yes.
So what were the next stages, you know, having been given that decision?
Well, the next stage was that I was summoned to a medical board in Oxford. I think at that time I was already wondering whether I'd done the right thing. And I remember talking to somebody on that occasion, getting quite passionate, saying that this person was saying he knew my situation and what I'd been awarded by the tribunal. And he said, of course, war is nasty and horrible, isn't it? And I said, no, it's wrong. It's wrong. It's wrong to kill. I cannot. So I remember that rather emotional conversation. And then I appeared before the doctor, and to my great surprise, he said I was C3 on account of some heart palpitations or something, which I had not been aware of before. That was a great surprise.
So was that a relief to you, you know, the fact that you weren't going to go into the non-combatant corps? I wonder how you felt about that.
I suppose it must have been a relief, yes, I suppose so. But it was a surprise and a disappointment in a sense that I left at Oxford. Would it be helpful if I say a word or two about Oxford at that time? About of course, some people who had been there before the war, immediately upon the outbreak of war, joined the FAU. Some people whom I'd known at Bootham, who'd overlapped with me, who were older than me, such as one of the Rountrees, Michael Rountree, I remember in particular. And there were others. There was the Cadet Corps, I forget its name, the Cadet Corps at Oxford, which a lot of my colleagues, my fellow students, served in. But it's a remarkable thing. It's a tribute, I think, to the tolerance and kindness of everybody. I was never made to feel uncomfortable for not joining that. I was never made to feel uncomfortable for having registered as a CO. There were quite a lot of us at that time who did so register. I was in touch in the early days, in the first year or so. I carried on with his interest in work camps. And I was secretary, university secretary for the IVSP at that time. And I received information about all the work camps and tried to disseminate it, encourage people to go on work camps.
What was it like there at Oxford, you know, the educational side of it during the war? Would you say that you had as good an education there as you might have had without a war? I was wondering about the tutors, you know, did any of the tutors depart for...
Well, some, yes, of course, some tutors had gone, and the tutors were filling in as best they can. Sometimes it meant that normally one wouldn't have had a professor as tutor, but sometimes one did for that reason, because they were filling in the gaps. I did a shortened, what was called a shortened wartime degree in history, which was a 2-year degree initially, and that I would have just completed that soon after my tribunal, so I would in any case have completed that shortened history degree. And some people were leaving them all the time when they were being called up. I was in a remarkably able group of people, I think, at Queen's College. There was quite a group of English students, some of whom became very distinguished subsequently. John Heath Stubbs, I read the other day in the newspaper, he's now chairman of the Poetry Society, but he's been publishing poetry for all his life. He was virtually blind at that time already, and I think he must be totally blind now. He and I were good friends. He used to talk a lot about the Welsh document, the Welsh book, the Mabinogion. And there was in about 1940, perhaps early 41, a group of these people published a book called Eight Oxford Poets. Alison Drummond, John Heath Stubbs, Sidney Keyes, who became a great name. He was at Queen's College. And one or two others. So there was a strong group of that sort. Then there was I think perhaps I was even more closely linked with another group of theologians. And they, of course, that was a reserved occupation. They were not being called up. And my special buddy was Dennis Nynham, who later became professor, Regius Professor of Divinity and all sorts of things, Warden of Keble College. But at that time, yes, we constantly, every afternoon, straight after lunch, we used to walk round Addison's Walk, which is the name of the Magdalen College, the name of the Riverside Walk, discussing putting the world to rights in all sorts of ways. There was another one, John Fenton, who became quite a distinguished theologian. I think he already at that time, we used to call him Archbishop Fenton, because, of course, historically speaking, there had been such a person. And
how was the war sort of impinging on Oxford? You know,
apart from the... Apart from the cadet corps, we knew of the war at a distance. Every year, Queen's invites an American academic historian to a year's residence in the college, and at that time there was one called Alan Nevins. And I remember the bombing of Southampton, and he, I think, was not only a historian but quite a journalist, and he and the college chaplain took a taxi from Oxford to Southampton in order that he could report on that. Coventry, that was later, wasn't it? But we were very much aware of the bombing, but we suffered no bombing there. In one of my vacations, I went to stay, I was invited to stay with a very lovely person called Hester Lever in she lived in Berkshire at Durham. That was just at the time of the evacuation of France, and it was a terrible time, of course. She received a telephone call, because not everybody had telephones in those days. She received a telephone call from a local man who had just come back from France, just been evacuated. And he asked her if she could go down and collect him from the station and bring him back to his home. And she and I went down to do this job, brought him back. So that was a di-